body as a servant, train it with love. You know, it's interesting to reflect on things that we normally overlook and don't pay much attention to. At least we may not pay attention to certain things in the way we could, that we live in. Let's let the question be, what is our relationship to these bodies? How much thought do you give? What is the relationship? Maybe a simple question would be, am I aware of a relationship with this body? Now, for some of you, let's say somebody like Natasha, who works, who does body work and is conscious of so much having to do with how the body works and its relationship to consciousness, this is almost a no-brainer. And yet, let's say we have a month that we're going to give to really looking at what our relationship is. And maybe even for somebody like Natasha, something new could be learned. We have two doctors, at least two doctors in the room, three doctors, I believe, in the room tonight. They work with bodies, and they have bodies. We have dancers, we have workers, we have actors and actresses. What do we know about this relationship? Yes, Rebecca.
It's a relationship of a step into the presence of my blood, my bones, my breath, my feet, dancing wild, evermore, seeking the empty space, inside, outside, same side. I learned today that when you hold a seashell at your ear, what you hear is, it sounds like the ocean, but it's your own blood rushing. And today I thought, wow, the ocean, didn't we talk about that one day here? The ocean is inside me, or I am the ocean, or the ocean. And
well, one thing that Eunice Emery says, you are the drop that contains the ocean.
Yeah. And a simple seashell can remind you of, can take you into a new perception of the relationship with the body. Touch, taste, smell. But then even more than that, my body within this group of bodies, I can somehow feel through my body all of you, and yet without, and none of you are my body. Do you follow? It's a ever adventurous relationship with my body as the wife to my spirit. Something like that.
Good. Wife to your spirit. Mm-hmm. So there's a marriage between spirit and flesh.
In the word marriage, I think of giving and receiving and witnessing, being with, all of that.
Thank you. Rebecca has been involved in a practice for many years now, 20 years or something like that, that has to do with spiritual movement and dance. There are many aspects to this relationship, so I'm just inviting us to kind of put it on the table. What else goes on? I mean, some people, does anybody suffer with your body, for instance? That's a relationship too. Does anybody feel, you know what Rumi says? I mean, we can say wonderful things about the body, he says. Body, you're wonder within wonder within wonder. That's true. He also says the body's like a coat of armor that's comfortable neither in winter or summer.
I've been thinking and reading lately about the idea that we are our bodies, that there is the idea that that we are sort of an immaterial ghost in the machine is one way to look at it, but not necessarily the only way to look at it. That we can look at it as if we are our bodies. Our bodies are who we are, and that consciousness and spirit is something that you can inspire through your breathing. So it's inside you, but it's also all around you. This is an idea that I've started to find really interesting. And in thinking about the possibility that we are our bodies, it's made me become much more aware of my body and then the breath as well. I've been doing two different forms of exercise in the past year or so. One is swimming and one is yoga. And it hit me the other day that both of them depend very much on breathing. Mm-hmm. In fact, in one of them, your life depends on breathing correctly when you're doing it. But that's what I've been thinking about in terms of my relationship with my body.
Thank you.
That's what it is. That's what everything is.
As you grow older, not everything works quite as well. Now, great gratitude that most everything works as well. But there's some pains that you started getting maybe in your 30s. And at some point, maybe you take ibuprofen, whatever. But the point is that the mechanics of the body begin to wear down some. And I think that heightens, it can, if you choose to have it, heightens the gratitude that you've had it all these years, and that it still works, and that it is still the armor, and the vehicle, the wife.
So as you've grown older, little by little, grown more mature, awareness increases, gratitude increases, appreciation, it's really consciousness. Something's growing in you. I heard a conversation between, I think it was Itzhak Perlman and his wife, and the question was raised, are you a better violinist now at the age of 70, whatever he is, maybe 75? And he said, I'm a much better violinist now than I was when I was 35. Though when I was 35, technically, I was much better. I could play things then that I might find difficult to play now. I had the virtuosity. But I'm a better violinist now because I can listen. And in listening, he could give to each phrase a meaning, rather than just playing the notes. He could play the notes really well before. Now he can listen. The teachings of Sufism, which are based on the experience of generations of realized beings who have shared their knowledge, their experience, not just beliefs, not just some philosophy, but have built upon inner experience, inner experience that includes experiencing different levels of reality. They're called levels of presence in Arabic and Farsi, Turkish, Hadra or Hazra. Different levels of presence. And the physical level is one level of presence. The world of bodies is one world that we're in. But we're also in other worlds simultaneously. And each level of presence has a knowledge particular to it. To be present and conscious on that level brings with it the knowledge of presence of that level. Other levels include, I mean, really obvious ones are, let's say, the level of emotions, the level of thoughts. That's all rather obvious to us. But then there's the level of divine qualities. Oh, even before we get there, there's a level that some call the astral plane, the psychic level. And then beyond that, the level of divine qualities or divine names. In zikr and certain contemplations in Sufism, we will use the divine names, we'll work with the divine names, and we'll have some, to some degree, an experience of those qualities. It might be qualities of beauty, of majesty, of subtlety, of life, of light. Beyond that is moving towards the levels of union with the divine source. But it's also kind of fundamental to this teaching, and I think to all real spiritual teachings, that it's possible for a human being to integrate all these levels and to be grounded. Grounded in the sense of not limited to the physical body or preoccupied with the physical body, but bringing all of those levels down in and to include also our experience of being embodied, which is a very different, could be a very different experience than the less, shall we say, conscious experience of being either suffering with the body or catering to it or just enjoying it in a physical sense. Let me share some words of Eunice Emre. Something quite extraordinary that he wrote many, well, 7 centuries ago. We entered the house of realization. We witnessed the body. The whirling skies, the many-layered earth, the 70,000 veils we found in the body. The night and the day, the planets, the words inscribed on the holy tablets, the hill that Moses climbed, the temple, and Seraphiel's trumpet we observed in the body. Torah, Psalms, Gospel, Quran, what these books have to say we found in the body. Everybody says these words of Eunice are true. Truth is wherever you want it. We found it all within the body. Interesting. Now, don't think that Eunice was an existentialist or a materialist, obviously. He was somebody who brought heaven to earth, brought heaven into his body, found heaven in his body. It's interesting. Do I understand it? No, I don't understand this. I believe it from what little experience I have of what he's talking about. I trust that Eunice Emre, one of the greatest mystical poets of all time, would not make this up or lie to us, would only talk about what he had experienced. The Quran says, God, the Divine says in the Quran, we created the human being in the most beautiful proportions. It doesn't even say the body, it says the human being. It must include the body. And much more. So, this month, if you do as little as I did today, which is actually to sign up with a personal trainer at Milestone, been waiting all year to do that, and I had to wait for this theme to come. And I better do something, you know, because I'm going to have to talk to these people tonight, you know, about the body. And, you know, I can't tell them to do something I myself haven't done. I couldn't ask of you something I don't do for myself. So Monday, 12 noon, I'm going to see my personal trainer in the physical world at the gym. I hope that's just the beginning. Now, does anybody remember the theme that I've mentioned twice at the beginning of the meeting? Westerners have such poor memories.
Give us a second.
What?
I have to go back for it.
Relationship with our bodies.
In general, that's a good generalization.
Like your body is a temple, but it was
something like that, like bring in love into. Yeah, you've got the ideas, not the words. Good.
Not the words.
It's good though.
Close.
Isn't it interesting?
Relate to your body with love, something.
Close.
Something like that. Yeah.
Something like that.
Is it your body is a servant?
Thank you. Body is a servant, treat it with love, train it with love. Yes, Rebecca.
Another thought along these lines that one of my teachers, well, Gabriel Roth said, was that she considered that everybody is a somebody when you're born. And the people are wanting to be a somebody, but we already are a somebody on a journey to becoming a no body.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that's beautiful and deep and very deep. In a way, our practice that began the evening tonight was becoming nobody. It's being in the pure I am. You're nobody, you're not. I mean, ideally, you're not thinking about me. You're not running through your own narratives, your own story at that moment. You're just developing, or shall we say, holding that presence.
I've always noticed this paradox when talking about the body, because the body is something that we see, something that we hear, and something that we can touch. And yet the body is also the thing that sees, the thing that hears, and the thing that touches. It's almost like we can speak of it at two different levels.
Mm-hmm. Is it the same body at both levels?
I mean, ultimately, I would say yes. Yeah, the body is just, it is that unity. Mm-hmm.
This is like a Buddhist thought where it has to go. Like that which observes pain is not in pain. But then, I guess it's kind of the question that you're kind of posing is that which is observing, is that the body or is that something else?
One thing,
first distance, yeah.
The body is what allows us to perceive. If we don't have the body, we can't perceive. And if we can't perceive, I'm not sure we can think. Or for that matter, possibly have emotions. So I think it all starts there. And I also just, in talking about signing up for the gym, I've been doing the yoga and the swimming for about a year now, and I feel like that's what led me to be more open to exploring spiritual matters. I know it is. I can't mm-hmm. exactly say how, mm-hmm. but I know that the two things are related.
Mm-hmm. Well, enlivening the body, you know, it gets those electrical systems working, and that sensitivity on finer levels begins to awaken more, so that, you know, openness can keep opening.
I'd like to come back to Matthew's proposal that the body is what sees, and what it sees is also the body, and Natalie's reference to another idea that what witnesses pain and what experiences pain are two different aspects, let's say. Shall I begin with this? There are people, there are blind people who have experienced a near-death experience on the table, and they leave their body and they see themselves. And they see other things too. So there's something that sees that can leave the body. This is clear. There's people in who spiritually developed people know that this is possible, that the body is not is no more than an instrument of consciousness, or is an instrument of consciousness, let's just call it that. And others would also say that we have different bodies on different levels. We have an astral body, we have a causal body, according to certain spiritual traditions. So there's a whole metaphysical teaching. We're not going to go into it tonight, but I think what I would like to just focus on a little bit and affirm is something very practical. We don't necessarily have to agree on all the metaphysics, but there is something that develops in the human being. It's a capacity for seeing. It's a capacity for being present. It's a capacity for being able to be in relationship to anything. And to be more cause than effect. In other words, we can be the kind of human beings who are tyrannized by our own bodies, who are ruled and mastered by our own bodies. If we have pain, it just totally preoccupies us. And the same could be said for emotions too. It's not just the physical, but and emotions which also are to some extent felt by the body can rule us, can master us. So our spiritual development is a development of mastery, pure and simple. And the mastery is coming from a different level of being, a different level of reality. And the more we know that level of reality, the more our I-ness is centered there, the more there is the possibility of this kind of mastery over our inner life, over our body, over our physical sensations, over our own healing, over all sorts of things. So what spirituality is about in all traditions, there's really no exception to this, is about awakening something at a certain level of reality that is conscious, that is intentional, ultimately that is also loving, by the way, and positive. I mean, you can actually awaken being and be even negative and even evil to some extent. You can go a certain distance awakening these faculties and use them for negative purposes. There is such a thing as black magic. There is such a thing as highly developed evil people who have extraordinary consciousness, extraordinary will. Even their thoughts can be destructive. But there are also spiritual laws that catch up with those people. A price is paid. But to go all the way, or to go further in this realm of will, consciousness, attention, inner mastery, love plays a role. Unity plays a role. These are attributes of that higher reality. We won't live at that higher reality without awakening those qualities. I'll give you an example. And maybe it's time to pass out what we have here. A little bit of poetry. And on the back side is something also a part of a chapter from Living Presence on the body. So we're just looking at the poetry side of the page. Well, we already read the first poem, so let's look at the second one, that quatrain. The cause of narrow-mindedness is multiplicity. Do we have... Good. The cause of narrow-mindedness is multiplicity. The senses are drawn in many directions. Know that the world of unification lies beyond sense. If you want unity, move in that direction. So this is a bit of a metaphysical proposition. We would think that maybe we're a little surprised to see that multiplicity is associated with narrow-mindedness, because we think multiplicity goes way out, covers a lot, covers everything. And especially when the senses are drawn in many directions. But Rumi's telling us, no, the world of unification lies beyond sense. If you want unity, move in that direction. Beyond sense here, I think we can take to mean that not being preoccupied with our sensory experience, not denying it, not abandoning it, but not being preoccupied and limited by it. Moving to that other level, moving in that direction that can encompass sense experience, the way the soul can be a dancer. And let's go over to Have You Lost Your Horse, O Derby People? So long as the heart does not see the giver of its conscience. Oh, let's just stop there for a minute. So long as the heart does not see the giver of its consciousness, and there's a little clue, giver is capitalized. It's not, of course, in Farsi. There's no caps in Farsi. So long as the arrow does not see the far-shooting archer, you may be the arrow, actually. Or you may not. You may just be the victim of the arrow. One who is that blind thinks his horse is lost. He's stubbornly spurring his horse along the way, but he thinks his horse, sweeping him onward like the wind, is lost. Interesting state of unconsciousness. Where is my horse? Where is my horse? The scatterbrain runs from door to door, searching everywhere and asking everyone, who stole my horse? Where is he? What is that you're sitting on, oh master? Yes, this is the horse. But where's the horse? Oh, you, in search of your horse, be aware of yourself. Be aware of yourself. So Rumi's telling us again, you know, the importance of this awareness. We run around thinking we have, thinking that we're missing something, and it's right here. And the final quatrain, I'm drunk from a cup engraved with the word love. The horse I ride has love for its reins. This love is a supreme work, but I am bound to the one who loves his slave. So Rumi always brings it back to love, but his love is a conscious love. It's a love that includes this masterful awareness. So love is an awareness that is sustained by a quality of consciousness that is not only conscious and aware, and this is really important, not only consciousness and aware, but it's a consciousness coming right from love. And the horse I ride has love for its reins. If the horse is the body, your vehicle, which is a beautiful energy. It's a beautiful energy and capacity to have. But anybody who knows about horses and knows the beauty of relationship of horse and rider, of rider and horse, it's a really beautiful thing. And horses love that relationship when it's a positive relationship. They respond to it. Because they are responding to consciousness. If you're not a conscious rider, the horse will definitely get the best of you. Our daughter is training horses in San Diego, and she took on this, she was given this dressage horse, which was an uptight, not very good dressage horse, but she recognized that this was not a dressage horse, this was a hunter-jumper. And by the grace of God, by absolute irrational, miraculous event, the stable owner just said, here, the horse is yours. And within weeks, that horse had become what it was meant to be, which is a beautiful jumper, and well-behaved, and his conformation changed, everything about him changed, under the love of the rider. It's not just attention, it's not just awareness, it's a kind of awareness. Does anybody remember the theme?
Body is a servant trained with love.
Bound to the one who loves his slave.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What is that? Somebody help Katie.
What was your question?
I'm a little mystified by the final line. I'm bound to the one who loves his slave.
I'm a slave. I'm a honestly.
Yeah. I'm bound as, I'm bound as a slave to the one who loves his slave.
Yeah. That too is describing a relationship. Rumi is saying this himself. He's calling himself a slave. I mean, he was one of the greatest human beings that ever lived. His intelligence, his creativity, his humility, his love was, you might say, unsurpassed. And yet he said, but I'm just a slave to the one. I'm not an abject slave to some cruel, dominating power. I'm a slave to the one who loves. If that's, and thank you for pointing it out, because it's a very, very important line. It's a very important, that's the, you might say, the core. You don't get deeper into Rumi's teaching than that. If we don't understand that, we don't understand what it's all about. And
that it coordinates with the line before, this love is a supreme work.
Could you quote a line that you said many months ago? You have a choice to be a slave of 18,000 masters.
Mm. Yeah. Well, actually it comes from the Quran. Is it, is the one who has many masters the same as one who has one master? And the practical side of this is that if we allow ourselves to be mastered by everything in this world, most of all by our desires, our random desires and distractions and fears and worries and our considerations of how we look and, you know, what people are thinking of us, we're enslaved to 18,000 things. And what the Quran is saying and what Rumi is saying is you can entrust yourself to the infinite. You can entrust yourself to the truth, the divine reality. Make all your cares into a single care, and God will see to all your cares. Make all your cares into a single care, namely, the intention, the wish, the yearning to remember God under all circumstances. And that divine power reciprocates. This is not New Age. This is not some key to abundant affluence at your own will's beckoning. This is about being a servant of love and knowing that joy, knowing that intimacy, knowing that that actually there is a power in the very nature of existence that responds to that, which is not a belief, not a theology. Either we experience it, or we can hope to experience it. Yeah. So the ordinary human ego is enslaved to 1,000 things. That's the nature of the ego, to be enslaved to this and that. The false self, which is governed by vanity and pride and fear and random desires, it's a false self. It's not your real self. Your real self, if you could find it, as Rumi says, when the last unreal you meets your first real you, when your last unreal you meets your first real you, you'll know. So bringing this all back to the body is a servant. You can say the body is an instrument. The body is wonderful, extraordinary, beautiful, creative instrument, which will also one day decline. But as it declines, it's possible that your soul will come shining forth in a way it never has, because actually it gets, with maturity, with spiritual development, it also gains a freedom from the body. It's no longer limited by it. But along the way, you know, to take care of the body, to get its energies flowing properly, you know, to balance the energies of the body, is absolutely essential to our well-being. And, but there is something in us that is potentially master in relationship to the body and servant in relationship to the real. The fact that you're a slave to the one who loves you does not mean that you're a slave to anything else. So, you know, this is a metaphysics of love. This is, you know, we're getting right to the heart of it. And we know it gradually, we know it better and better by awakening our attention, by learning to still the mind and emotions, by learning to value just the experience of simple being, of being present. And in deepening in that presence, we then find that actually we're in relationship to the infinite. We find that through our own presence, we are in fact capable of a relationship with the infinite and with others and each other. Matthew?
I'd like to ask or talk about bliss. It's like the body in bliss.
It's not the body that's in bliss. It's your spirit that is in bliss, because bliss is, you know, to put it into Sanskrit, Satchitananda, you know, it's the very nature of reality is bliss.
Would you say there's something in the body, or an interpretation of the body? Is the body separate? That's one question. Is my body separate from your body or any other body in the room? Is it separate from the universe? Is it separate from anything? You know, I've seen hospice patients, for instance, whose, by all rational accounts, should be in excruciating physical pain. Mm-hmm. And something shifts and they're in bliss.
Yes.
Mm. So just the practical, you know, not theoretical, but the practical mechanisms of bliss in this moment, basically, and the barriers to that as it would exist in this moment is really what I'm asking about.
Yeah. There's clearly there's a source we can draw on, that the soul can draw on, that is infinite, that is of that the nature of bliss. It is power, it is light, it is the infinite. There was a story of a, let me tell you a story of Ibn Adam, an early Sufi. Mm-hmm. He had been a king, and he gave up his kingdom to become a Sufi, become a dervish. And he went off for years and years and years, and he wandered through the desert, and he was poor, and he was a beggar, and he matured. Eventually he came back to where he was from, and he returned to a mosque that he had built as a king. And just because he thought, well, I can at least sleep here tonight. So he was sleeping in this mosque that he had built when he was the sultan. And the watchman of the mosque found him there and thought he was a bum and grabbed him by his leg and pulled him out of the mosque and pulled him down the stairs. And as his head hit every single stair, And when he got down to the bottom, his only thought was, I wish I had built more stairs. When I was salted. And that sounds like a kind of pathological hunger for self-punishment. But I experienced it at least once in my life. And I was in Turkey, and I had really hurt my back. I had probably a herniated disc. I had to be bedridden for about 10 days, and I wasn't getting any better. And I had to get back to Istanbul to catch a flight. I really had no choice. And to get to Istanbul, I had to ride 10 or 12 hours by bus. And in fact, in the back seat of the bus, which doesn't recline, and which bounces more than anything else. And I had been riding, and every 3 or 4 hours, the bus stops, you get a chance to get off. And at one point, about halfway through that journey, and I had been in really extraordinary pain. You know what that pain can be like. It's just blinding pain. And I got off the bus, and I stepped into that bliss. It was just there. You know, I guess you could say so was the pain, but the bliss could outweigh the pain. So that experience is always here for us, but we're blocked from it in various ways. But it's potentially available to us, and it can overcome, supersede any sensation of the body. That's why we are not just our body. I mean, we could argue over what that means, and we could discuss what that means. We're not going to argue. But there's something beyond the body, there's something beyond our normal egoistic emotions. And apart from an extreme experience like that, which, thank God, only comes occasionally, I mean, both the pain and the bliss, there's something we can know with certainty and with sustainability, which is that the human heart can be connected to a state of being that is a state of well-being beyond circumstance. It's not tied to any circumstance. It's very real. It's not so far away. It's not a miraculous accomplishment of rare saints. It is the right of the lovers of God, the faithful. The knowers, maybe that's a better word, the knowers, to know that. You know, and how do you come to know that? Well, through practice, through spiritual practice, through a certain amount of suffering, through a lot of things. Because, you know, Rumi would say that everything in our life is conspiring to help us realize it. Everything. Because the divine mercy is that comprehensive. The very nature of the infinite is divine mercy. And it wants every human being to know that state of well-being, beauty, where you know you are the recipient of that generosity, no matter what circumstances happen. It doesn't guarantee that your life's going to be easy or you're not going to face grievous disappointments at times. But they're all changed in this perspective. And what we're talking about is not, you know, this is not a belief system. I mean, it is partly a belief. Maybe it begins as a kind of belief or a teaching, but it must move to experience. And there are practical ways the human soul can develop that capacity. You know? So, as Natalie said, it's not just a Buddhist teaching. It's a universal. It is applied spirituality. The one who witnesses the suffering is different than the one who identifies with the suffering. The one who says, I'm hurting, you know, I'm in such pain, I feel so bad, I'm so miserable, is really suffering. But the one who notices, Kabir is suffering, or Kabir is sad, or Kabir is hurting, that is happening in a different context. It's happening in a context of, well, let's try and understand, why is Kabir hurting? Why is Kabir sad? Let's look at it. Let's, knowing that there may be teaching in it, knowing that there is probably blessing in it, Bilal, did you have to say?
Yeah, I mean, I had a comment about the body and spirit. Mm-hmm. And there's a very palpable interplay between both of them. Even people who are sleep deprived, you're more prone to be irritable, be short with people. Your spirit is not as happy as in general. It's mm-hmm. not at its best or often.
Right.
Since if you gain a lot of weight, you're sluggish. You're not feeling good about yourself, your spirit is affected. If you give yourself bodily pleasure, that's a temporary pleasure. Doesn't cause as much ecstasy as getting spiritual pleasure. If your soul is at peace, it's much more of an ecstasy, or much more likely to have. You know, when I come here, I kind of, I'm going downhill all week, and then I come here and I feel spiritually much better. There's hope and light. And, I can do whatever, all the pleasures I want all week, it doesn't give me the same pleasure that the body gives. And even fasting itself, we starve our bodies, we starve our animal. And that month is supposed to be torturous, but all of us who fast feel much better at the end of the month because we've controlled our soul.
Right.
All the vices we do, we control. And so there's definitely an interplay.
Yeah. Thank you. Exactly. So that's recognizing where the real leverage is, and the delusion of the ego, the delusion of the nafs is to be confused about how well-being is achieved and what real pleasure is. So all this is very practical. And I'll come back to leave us with one more thought, which is, I think, a very positive thought, that the human body is a transformer of subtle energies. This is the spiritual nature of the body, and this is a really big truth. Everyone's body is a transformer of subtle and not so subtle energies. If we can understand how this works, then this body becomes literally a transformer, taking one kind of energy and taking it to another level. And spiritual practice in many, many forms is that process of refining the energies that are available to us. Whereas mindlessly giving in to satisfying the body generally is a loss of energy and a lowering of vibrational rate. Spiritualizing even the body's desires, sometimes through fasting, sometimes through physical discipline, and sometimes just by bringing awareness into everything, like bring awareness into taste, bring awareness into fragrance, enhances the pleasure of the senses, but also can free us from our slavery to the senses. So this is what we're always working with. We're learning, it's a skill to learn how to be fair to the body, how to treat it well enough so that it doesn't get in the way and become an obstacle. Sometimes too little sleep can make us irritable. But, the Sufis actually used the discipline of too little sleep to go to another level too. So you can go both ways. too much sleep, too much food, too much talking, etc., can bring us down. We're talking about mastery. We're talking about a conscious relationship with our bodies, our emotions, our thoughts, and even higher levels. It all begins quite simply. Just be aware, breath by breath. Learn to be more intentional with your life. Learn to be more patient, less judgmental, less reactive. But to do those things requires a spiritual energy that has to come from somewhere. It has to be kindled somehow. It has to be awakened somehow. So we're learning about this. We'll continue to learn and just observe and see more about our relationship with our bodies. You know, we should love them, respect them. Wake up, still alive, still here. As one of our sheikhs says, "How are you?" He says, "Still dying." And then, you know, the mystics say, the ones who, the knowers say, that just as the embryo fears being born from the womb into this world, we fear our next birth. We fear being born from the womb of this material existence. Just as the embryo couldn't imagine that there was anything better than sort of, you know, drinking blood in the womb, and then came out into this world of colors and fragrance and, you know, sensory experience and relationship. We too, human beings, fear being born beyond the limitations of our egoic existence. And Prophet Muhammad said, "Die before you die. Know that after-death state now." That's also a goal of the spiritual path, to be living in two worlds at once, to bring heaven to earth. Evolah.